This is the Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for listening this week. It was 1 year ago. All of Florida was bracing for Hurricane Irma, especially South Florida. The storm's predicted path was slowly shifting west, likely sparing Miami-Dade, Broward, and Palm Beach counties from the worst of the winds, the rain, and the storm surge. When it made landfall a year ago Monday in the Lower Keys, Irma would be a Category 4 storm, bringing with it water as high as 9 feet in some places. It effectively closed the Keys for a week. Residents who followed the warnings and evacuated were not allowed back in for days. The storm ripped through islands, destroying and heavily damaging thousands of homes and businesses, scrubbing the landscape and scattering lives. 1 year later, much of the debris on land may be cleaned up and not without its own controversy, but flotsam still litters canals throughout the Keys. Rebuilding efforts are uneven, and reminders of the storm are only a weather forecast away. This is where we begin this week on the Florida Roundup. Have you recovered from Hurricane Irma over the past year? What are the reminders of the storm to this day? 800-743-WLRN is our phone number to join our conversation. 800-743-9576. You can also share your reminders of Hurricane Irma, lessons learned, by sending us a tweet at WLRN is our handle. This is Cindy Fleming from Cutler Bay.
We're still dealing with Hurricane Irma here at the house. Our mandatory windstorm coverage did not pay for any of the damage. Our screen porch that connects to the back of the house is being held up by a 2x4 because apparently they're not covered by windstorm coverage. We still have some trees down. They said that our damages didn't meet the deductible, so they don't have to cover anything.
Hi, this is Ricardo from Miami. I think the biggest reminder is the $5,000 hole it left my home finances that won't be reimbursed by insurance. And that would be for things like the pre-storm prep and the evacuation to Orlando and then the post-storm cleanup.
This is Albert Gomez from North Coconut Grove. About a year ago today, I was preparing for Hurricane Irma. With $400, I bought Gorilla Tape, pond liner, some foam filler, and 200 kitchen bags, which I filled with dirt. And even though we got 4 feet of storm surge, I saved my house. My yard is still coming back. Up the street from my house, there's 3 homes still under construction and a 4th shuttered. And the seawall just on the corner near a bridge is fractured right down the center. And about 4 feet back, the land is eroded.
I still see blue tarps on many houses, roofs that are still being repaired, gardens that are still damaged. And in the Florida Keys, there are still houses that have not been repaired. There's a lot of rebuilding still to be done.
Reminders of Hurricane Irma a year ago are all around us here in South Florida in many different ways. How about for you? 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. WLRN's southernmost reporter, Nancy Klingener, is with us from Key West, the studios of Key West. Nan, it has been, in some cases, it feels like a short year, feels like a long year for a number of people. How would you describe the recovery, especially in the Lower Keys, 1 year on?
Yeah, I mean, it has been both a very short and a very long year in my perception, and I think the perception of the community in general. And it's really, it's a tough one for a lot of people who have not gotten the reimbursement from their insurance companies that they might have expected after paying premiums all these years.
Yeah.
People who didn't have a lot of margin to recover in the first place. Those are the folks it's really been the hardest on.
What do the Keys look like for those that haven't been down over or through the overseas highway? Or for that matter, maybe they have, but have traveled kind of directly to Key West.
Yeah, if you just drove down the overseas highway, you could probably tell there was a major storm, but it wouldn't seem like devastation. It's once you get into the neighborhoods of the Lower Keys around Big Pine Key, Cudjoe, Ramrod, and there you can still see either empty lots where a structure that was destroyed has been removed, or you can see houses that have blue tarps on the roof or other signs of damage.
Or construction staging areas as well, or signs dotting the highway reminding folks that to use licensed contractors in repair jobs.
Yeah, that's been a big issue, too, is a lot of people sort of learned the lessons of Hurricane Andrew and Hurricane Wilma and others and really wanted to rely on local contractors so that, if there was a problem, they could deal with it. Mm-hmm. And just because these are people they trusted. But, there aren't that many local contractors in the Keys, and they've just been overwhelmed and backed up. I mean, just getting a fence replaced, people are still waiting for minor stuff like that.
What are the challenges 1 year on that Keys residents, full-time Keys residents, are experiencing? And for that matter, the seasonal residents who will be coming back in the months ahead are going to encounter?
Well, the challenge for the full-time residents either is, trying to get the money together to rebuild or repair your home, or finding an affordable rental if you don't own a home. I mean, that's been a problem in the Keys for decades. And, with Irma taking out 4,000, units with major damage or destroyed, and a lot of those units were the ones that provided the housing for the people who worked here, it's just gotten that much worse.
The issue of housing is one that is present. So it was present before Irma. It was present a year ago today before Irma. And it was present certainly well after Irma, because so much of the housing stock was taken out. Some of that was mobile homes, which are it's going to be difficult to bring a new mobile home back into unincorporated Monroe County. How is the housing issue? What are the different ways that the county and the cities are addressing the housing challenge that Irma has really exploited?
Well, I know that you recently spoke with Christine Hurley from the county mm-hmm. about what they're looking to do, but all of that is pretty long term. It's not something where they can promise somebody a nice, safe, stable place to move into tomorrow. There's a new land trust in town that is building cottages that are, built to withstand 200 mile an hour winds and be affordable for people who live and work here. And that's great. But I think they have a total of 8 underway at this point.
Yeah.
So it's a great model, but it's not something that, is going to fix this problem tomorrow. The state has also offered to approve 1,300 new units in the Keys, which is a big deal because mm-hmm. we're limited in how much we can build in the Keys. And these would be only for affordable workforce rentals. And I think the county and each of the municipalities would get 300. Mm. The question there is they wouldn't fall under the county's limit for hurricane evacuation. And they say that the people who live there would be required to evacuate 48 hours ahead of time. Hmm. When the tourists leave and people in mobile homes are supposed to leave. But then there's the issue of, what kind of notice do you get? We just had an example this week where we woke up Monday morning and there was a tropical storm in Key Largo.
Yeah. There were no tropical storm watches or warnings posted for for any of South Florida, for that matter. And Monday was thankfully just a washout, and hopefully everybody was able to be okay with Gordon there. Speaking with Nancy Klingener here, almost 1 year after Hurricane Irma, what are the reminders of the storm for you in your neighborhood, in your community? 800-743-9576, 800-743-WLRN. We'll go to Summerlin Key, where Lawrence is online too. Lawrence, thanks for calling in today. What are the reminders for you 1 year on?
Well, in my case, the house, we lost 2 bedrooms and a bath. The doors were completely ripped off. The shutters, which were double shutters, storm shutters, were ripped off. The sea went through the house. The house is directly on the water, so that was an issue with the 9-foot surge.
Yeah. What type of home is it? A single-family home, mobile home?
Single-family home, part masonry or wood.
Mm-hmm.
But the alarming thing to me and significant thing about the storm is the hammock itself, that our property has been left since I've owned it for 30 years as a native hammock. And with native growth, buttonwoods, gumbo limbo, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
And the trees on the lot, which is about 400 feet deep from the street, the largest trees, which were at least 100 years old, all are flattened, uprooted and just on the ground.
Yeah.
And I'm leaving it to regroup as nature will have it.
You're leaving those large trees on the ground. You haven't cleaned them up.
No. I just cleared a path, the drive into the house, and I'm leaving the vegetation as it was. I assume that this has happened before.
Yeah. Are you rebuilding the home, Lawrence?
Yeah, I'm rebuilding the home, and we're living in it.
Hmm.
But the thing is, to me, the significant thing is obviously the sea has not been this high, deposited this much salt, left that much salt on the ground so that it essentially killed the vegetation.
Yeah.
And native vegetation. I have nothing but native growth on this property.
Yeah, Lawrence, I appreciate you sharing your thoughts here. We're glad you're still with us here in South Florida and wish you and your family the best there in Summerlin Key as you continue to rebuild. Thanks so much for calling into the Florida Roundup here on WLRN. Nan, how about Lawrence's experience? How unique do you think that is? How typical is that in your estimation?
Yeah, I mean, certainly a lot of the Keys got a pretty good storm surge from Irma, especially in Isla Mirada, too, on the ocean side there. There was a lot of damage that hasn't gotten as much attention as the Big Pine and Lower Keys area. And that definitely has an effect, especially with sea level rise. We've already seen the pine rocklands of the Lower Keys are getting saltwater intrusion, and areas that have been pine rockland, you know, for eons are becoming mangrove areas. And I'm sure this probably just accelerates that process.
And this idea that Lawrence describes there, you know, I mean, clearly some pretty significant damage to his single-family home, a couple of bedrooms and a bathroom washed out. Living in it while repairing it. You get off the overseas highway in some of those neighborhoods and the Torches and Cudjoe, but you know, Grassy Key and elsewhere, a lot of folks share that experience.
Yeah, people are sort of semi-camping out in their own homes while they're doing this, or they've got an RV in the driveway that they're living in. Yeah, there's a lot of sort of ad hoc building and repair going on.
Yeah. The phone number, 800-743-WLRN, coming up on the one-year anniversary of Hurricane Irma. It's on Monday, clearly a year ago today. Odds are you were rushing around trying to prepare for the storm. Maybe you were stuck in traffic trying to get out of the Keys or trying to get out of Dade, Broward, or Palm Beach County, going over the Alligator Alley over to southwest Florida, trying to get up to Orlando or points north. But Irma, that forecast had the entire peninsula in that cone of uncertainty, as all of us can recall 1 year ago. Boca Raton is up next, where Joe is on line one. Joe, thanks for calling in. You're on the radio.
Hi there. This is Joe from Boca Raton, Florida. We were in the process of renovating a property in Key Largo, and when the storm hit, we've unfortunately been unable to get it functional, but what causes me greatest discomfort is that people within our community there and in surrounding communities looking for residents, we're unable to provide them because it's not truly habitable, and the workers, et cetera, that we have sent down have not gotten the project to snuff to allow people to come in, even at a base rent, just for so we can provide shelter for workers and residents down there. Secondly, and although Irma hit the Keys very hard, and so I live in two worlds, here in my home, we moved into this area in 1982, had a huge ficus tree, almost 100 feet tall and 200 feet wide, offered shade and all. And Irma, despite all the other hurricanes, Francis, et cetera, in a snap broke and brought up all the lines, et cetera, and that cost us $10,000 to $12,000 to clear and break down. So it's the unseen cost. These are the back of the house on the canal. But even to those of us who could in some way afford to clear our land, it has become real hardship. I'm retired right now, and there are limited resources, but you do what you have to do, and it's just really unfortunate.
Joe, thanks for sharing your experiences with us, and that idea certainly of foliage on the mainland dropping down. You know, there are lots of places where all of us probably drive or walk on the mainland, that there's a lot more sunshine coming through this September than there was a year or a year and a half ago because of Irma. Nan Klingener, our southernmost reporter with us from the studios of Key West. I want to pick up on what Joe talked about, having difficulty repairing a home that he owns in Key Largo to provide housing for workers. Housing is a significant issue, and you touched upon it. You know, the demand remains the same, but it really becomes a catch-22 where that it's difficult for workers, full-time residents who are affected directly with their homes, to find homes to stay in the Keys. And it's difficult for those homeowners and business owners to provide housing or to have the workers have housing in order to fix up their buildings so that they can either reopen or remain open over the past year.
Yeah, that has been a problem, and not just people to fix up the workers, but it's even been a problem for the volunteer crews right. that came in. People came from all over the country to help out and did tremendous work to help people in the Keys, but there was a problem of where could they stay
right.
while they
That's
were
right.
doing that.
That's right.
And
you know,
early on, when the tourism industry was really hurting, you know, a lot of them were in our local hotels. Yeah. But once that industry got going again, you know,
yeah.
that wasn't available.
FEMA provided extension for those hotel vouchers for local residents to continue to stay in the hotels. And when I would go down there and report, and when you and I would talk in December and January and February, the height of the season, what you would hear back from the locals is, we just need the hotels to reopen. We need the hotels to reopen.
Right. Yeah, that's another catch-22. You know, you need the income from the hotels, but you also need a roof over your head
right.
while you're trying to get your life back together.
Yeah, we asked folks, you know, what are the reminders of Hurricane Irma 1 year on? Jan in Little Torch said, living on plywood floors, no kitchen sink, no insulation in the attic. Jenny in Key West, we have new gardens where we lost a huge tree. Our fence is still awaiting replacement because it's so hard to find a contractor. There's still damage to wallboard where I pulled it out, checking for mold. Overall, very minor stuff compared to what other people dealt with. We were lucky, writes Jenny in Key West. Suzanne in Key West saying the tarp roofs is her reminder of Hurricane Irma 1 year on. 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576 here on the Florida Roundup, speaking with Nan Klingener. Let's talk about how this past year, Nan, has compared post-Irma to the year after Wilma or the year after George, two other big storms that affected the Keys, two other storms that you lived through.
Yeah, it's hard for me to remember back to George. I did have a Spanish lime tree come down on my house in George.
That was only 1998.
Was
come on, only yep, 20 yep. years ago.
And Wilma, to me, was sort of, we got an early start on the bursting of the real estate bubble with Wilma here in the Keys. Mm. It almost feels like the recession started then because we had been seeing huge speculation, people buying properties, you know, dozens of properties and flipping them and seeing the prices just skyrocket. And after Wilma, that just deflated quickly.
It's been almost the opposite reaction this time around.
Yeah, it's been pretty amazing. Our average home sales haven't dropped at all. In fact, they've gone up a little bit, and our tax base has gone up.
Yeah.
Which is amazing.
At a time when I think by the county's count, almost 5,000 properties were damaged or heavily destroyed by the storm. So the supply has gone down, demand continues there, and that has meant higher prices in the year for property in the Keys, throughout the Keys, throughout the chain.
Right. That's because in the Keys, the land itself yeah. is most of the value,
yeah.
you know, not the structure,
right.
especially when the structure is, say, a mobile home.
Yeah. Speaking with Nan Klingener about 1 year after the Keys, the reminders in your life, Kathy in Summerland wrote us, blue tarps, contractor trailers are in the neighborhood working on roofs, siding, railings, and screens. Robert on Ramrod Key said, there are six empty lots within my view that once contained nice people and the homes they lived in. What about vacant homes or vacant lots, lots that have had homes destroyed on them? Is there a noticeable hollowing out in some of these keys?
I would say so. Certainly
yeah.
in the Avenues neighborhood of Big Pine, you see that with either a wrecked structure or no structure at all where it's been removed. Yeah, absolutely.
What about the evacuation lessons 1 year on? Of course, you know, there's really not an option, officially speaking, to stay in the Keys when you've got a hurricane warning like we had a year ago. But there was a lot of criticism of how the Keys and the Monroe County government and others handled the return trip, essentially closing down the overseas highway for a week. Remember, the storm hit September 10th. They didn't open up the overseas highway again until September 17th. And even then, it was only until mile 46, which is just above where the worst of the damage was experienced.
Well, I think some of the Upper Keys and Middle Keys folks were able to get back in a little bit earlier, but it was definitely a week before they let people back to the Lower Keys and Key West. And if you talk to not just the emergency management folks, but even people from the cities, they're saying it's not safe to have people here when, you know, our water supply was tenuous and you couldn't flush the toilets. That's just like it's not a safe living condition for people. The county has started up a new volunteer emergency volunteer program, and apparently about 250 people have gone through the course to get certified. And it's not a short course at all. It's a serious training, and they don't get permission to stay, but they will get a special placard the county calls a golden ticket that will let them back in early, because they figure, you know how to keep yourself safe. We know that you know what kind of supplies you'll need to be independent. Another concern is that all the folks who stayed in Key West, where it wasn't that bad, think, oh, this is great. I made it through a Category 4 hurricane and it wasn't that bad, when in fact we only had maybe Category 1 or 2 conditions here in Key West.
Yeah. And then finally, Nan, before we let you go, what about the psychological health, the mental health aspect of this? You've reported on this. We're going to have some reporting next week on it, on our Sundial program as well. As you live there and member of that community, what are your experiences?
Yeah, that has been, I would say, the most severe impact in a way. It's really stressful to go through this financially, and just to live in a community that isn't the community that you knew. And overnight it changed. And, you know, people have left, jobs have been lost. And it's a really, really hard thing for the community. And I would say, you know, you can feel it all. You can feel that definitely all up and down the Keys.
Yeah. Nan Klingener with us, our southernmost reporter from the studios of Key West, talking about 1 year since Hurricane Irma. Nancy, I know you spent the hurricane there in the Keys for the WLRN listeners. Again, I want to thank you for that act of bravery and journalism, and the journalism that you continue to provide for all of our listeners as the Keys continue to recover after Hurricane Irma. Thanks, Nan.
Thanks, Tom.
We got plenty more to come. Again, what are your memories of Hurricane Irma? Ibis in Miami, there are still street signs that are fallen, such as speed limit signs. Susan in Broward County, we're still trying to rebuild our fence, which went down in Irma, waiting for a permit, fighting with the Homeowners Association. Ugh, Susan in Broward writes. Gord and Davey, first, our roof remains damaged, pending repairs of $8,400 if and when money is found. Probably more than 45 other homes within a half-mile radius are the same. Scads of blue tarps in Davey, writes Gord. How about your experiences? 800-743-9576, 800-743-WLRN. As the Florida Roundup continues, lessons from Irma, preparing and protecting the most vulnerable communities. That's next. Welcome back to the Florida Roundup here on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks again for listening and supporting public radio. Bad storms expose weaknesses. They find vulnerabilities, sometimes leading to deadly consequences. That was the case with Hurricane Irma and electricity. The storm knocked out power for millions of people, including the patients at the rehabilitation center at Hollywood Hills. 12 patients died in the days after the storm. The nursing home lost power and lost its air conditioning. Pedro Franco's father, Miguel, died after 3 days without air conditioning at the rehab center. 4 weeks later, his mother, Cecilia, who is also a Hollywood Hills resident, died too.
We trusted these people that are supposed to be professionally trained to save people's life.
The home has since closed, but the deaths led to a new state law requiring nursing homes and assisted living facilities to have emergency plans to permanently provide backup power. The homes have to be able to keep their temperature at or below 81 degrees for 4 days after losing electricity. If you have a family member in a nursing home or you work at one, is it ready for the next storm, for the next power outage? 800-743-WLRN. This is one of those lasting impacts of Hurricane Irma 1 year ago. 800-743-9576. Katie Swetalski, WLRN's Broward County reporter, joins us via Skype. Katie, you have sat in on some of the conversations around nursing homes and the response to Hurricane Irma. There's been a kind of a state committee that's talked about this. Are nursing homes in Florida prepared for the next big power outage?
Hi, Tom. Yes, I have. And I think what the key takeaway here is it's really changed the mindset of how Broward County is preparing for the next storm. And I think that's important for a couple of reasons, because sitting in on these meetings, you notice that what should be a state responsibility under ACA, under the Agency for Healthcare Administration, the county level has had to pick up a lot of responsibility for this, assuming during a next big storm that they have to manually go check on these facilities, whether they have backup power or not.
Hmm. The Wall Street Journal reported just this week that about 75% of nursing homes in Florida got an extension to be prepared under the state law. 90% of assisted living facilities are compliant. The extension goes through January of next year, so they've got to get this these power plans together. What are the difficulties in complying with the law?
Mostly it's been affordability issues. You know, you hear nursing homes talk a lot about how expensive generators and the fuel for this critical 96-hour period is, and they just don't want to pay for it all up front. And so I think they're kind of waiting to see if the state will help them at all or find other ways to meet the requirements. But really, it should be generators instead of portable AC.
Well, I was just going to ask you how homes are meeting these requirements, because as I understand it, the law doesn't specify that you have to have a generator per se, as opposed to just the result of having power, this temperature at 81 degrees or below for 4 days after losing electricity. How you generate that, I guess, is up to the nursing home or the assisted living facility's owner.
Yes, that's true. There have been reports, you know, after the deaths that happened at the rehabilitation center at Hollywood Hills, that bringing coolers in after the fact actually hurt and not helped. So I think the emphasis is really on trying to get these facilities to have full-fledged generators so that they don't have to rely on the county as much.
Katie Swetalski, WLRN's Broward County reporter via Skype. Stick with us here, Katie, because Hurricane Irma also revealed shortcomings in how communities prepare for the storm, certainly, and the difficulty in quickly providing dozens of shelters for thousands, tens of thousands of people throughout South Florida. Remember, a year ago, there was a lot of confusion and crowding at shelters with large swaths of South Florida under an unprecedented evacuation order. It has led to new neighborhood preparation efforts throughout the area. Valencia Gunder watched as some people in Miami-Dade and Broward struggled to afford supplies 1 year ago.
I really want to change the culture of that in our communities. I want people to start making this a part of their daily conversations, because if you stay prepared, you won't have to get prepared.
Valencia is back with us here on the Florida Roundup. Kate Stein, WLRN's environmental and transportation reporter, also with us back on the Florida Roundup. Valencia, you talked about wanting to change the culture. What is the culture you're trying to change after Irma?
So usually climate and hurricane preparedness is not most folks' like first priority when they're thinking about like preparing their homes about anything, like when they go shopping and things like that. And, you know, hurricane season comes every year. Yeah. And I don't understand why residents, especially in South Florida, do not prepare for hurricane season year round. Like, that should be dinner conversation, family conversation all the time, because hurricane season has been coming for a long time and it's going to continue to come. So I really, really want to push communities to really start making this a part of their everyday lives to be prepared for hurricane season.
How are you doing that? How have you been doing that in the year after Irma?
So myself and my colleague Nancy Mateer, we took the data from last year, all the communities we went into last year, and we went back through and we did community meetings, and we decided to create our own Florida Disaster Resiliency Plan. And we identified community captains, and we identified resources or the lack thereof in each community, and we decided to create community hubs. And we designated community captains in each community. Mm-hmm. So this year when we're preparing, we know what communities need. We know where we can take the supplies and how we can get it out even faster.
Did you find that that kind of informal social infrastructure in neighborhoods just non-existent?
Yes, it's definitely not. It seems as if to get assistance, it was a lot of red tape, a lot of like forms to fill out, having to go to all these different places and call up these different hotlines. And, you know, folks just didn't have the time or understand how to do it. So just having like a very social grassroots movement and space to get resources out to community and information made it so much easier.
Kate Stein, several of us can remember, and I know you can as well, those shelters. You spent Hurricane Irma in a shelter, but the confusion in the days leading up to it of how folks that may not have transportation, how do they get to the shelter? Some shelters weren't staffed up right away. They were open, but there wasn't enough staff, or the communication of which shelter was open when. Lots of confusion. What were your experiences?
So last year during Hurricane Irma, I was in a shelter at Miami Edison Senior High School, which is between Liberty City and Little Haiti. And I think that what I saw there was a reflection of some of what Valencia has worked on in the past year, which is that in low-income communities or communities of color, sometimes the resources aren't there or the mindset isn't necessarily. And I think for a lot of communities, the mindset isn't, we don't, you know, it's a hurricane, it's hurricane season. You know, we can try to stock up, but is it really like top of mind? Not necessarily. And especially for people who are kind of already vulnerable because of their economic situation, it can be hard. And Valencia, I think you can speak to this better than I can, but it can be hard to, you know, stock up in advance on food. Or if you don't have a car, how are you going to go and get, you know, get to a shelter? And right. So one of the things that I saw in my reporting was that for people who don't have that backup in, or who don't have the means to, you know, have a 3 days worth of food or drive themselves to a shelter, the backup really wasn't there from Miami-Dade County.
Right.
And in the shelter, that kind of looked like, you know, people showing up, they didn't have cots, they didn't know they needed to bring bedding for a hurricane. In the particular shelters that they were in, mm-hmm. you know, a lot of people were confused. They thought that it was a shelter that would be staffed for people with special needs. And so the communication right. issue came back yeah. there, too.
Katie Swatowski, what about the response in Broward County about some of the shelter challenges that were experienced there?
I think what the county really figured out is they didn't have enough shelter options up here in Broward open. And so this year, that's one of the things that they were reminding seniors at a meeting of a congressional senior consortium was, hey, you know, between the Red Cross and between the county, we're going to expand our possibility of opening up more shelters. So there are more shelters open or available to be opened this hurricane season than there were last year.
One of the other real responses we saw in Miami-Dade County, Valencia, was the county saying that the Red Cross or National Guard will now staff these shelters. Is that a solution in your estimation?
Not necessarily, because from what I understand, well, not the National Guard, I'm not familiar with their program, but I know the Red Cross had an issue with finding volunteers right. to be able to man certain stations and provide certain resources that they had in place. So, I mean, even though I have a good relationship with the Red Cross, they were not able to respond to communities properly because of that. So I don't know if that would be the proper solution to an issue.
And, well, could I ask, if I can jump in and ask you a question, Valencia, one of the things you did last year after Hurricane Irma was organize basically a statewide cookout almost, where you got a bunch of volunteers and people to bring their grills and, you know, start cooking for people who didn't have food after the storm. Is that sort of response something that you have also decided to include in the, you know, hurricane preparation things that you've been working on around Miami-Dade?
Most definitely. It's called the Community Emergency Operations Center. So last year, 48 hours before the storm, I identified a warehouse space and started to stockpile. And right after the storm, within like 12 to 14 hours, we were out in communities and we were doing pop-up feeding operations. And we assisted over 23,000 residents across the county in South Broward. And this year we have the warehouse open. We just had the grand opening for the warehouse again. So the Community Emergency Operations Center is up and running again. We already started it to stockpile communities. We used all of those meetings that we had over the year to prepare, and we are actually like literally waiting to see if a storm is coming. We have a list of over 500 volunteers. We're working with over 25 organizations, so we are looking extremely good.
And I think one thing that's really interesting, Tom, is that Miami-Dade County is starting to see the efforts of Valencia and the people that she works with as part of their hurricane response plan. You know, Jim Murley, the Miami-Dade Resilience Officer, and Jane Gilbert, the City of Miami Resilience Officer, were both at the opening this past weekend of the Community Emergency Operations Center. So the county is looking for opportunities to bridge some of the gaps that happened last year during Irma.
I was just going to ask you, Valencia, you're right. I mean, the effort that you've had on the community organizing here, clearly in response to where you saw a deficit. Yeah, both a deficit culturally, as you mentioned, in terms of the community awareness or the community engagement, but is there also a deficit in terms of the kind of institutional response or the institutional network that has set up in the communities that you're addressing?
Yes. So ultimately, our institutions, their disaster response plans are not necessarily equitable all the time. They look at vulnerability in a completely different definition than most folks do across our county. Hmm. And
how so?
Well, you know, they say that just youth and elders are vulnerable, but we know that's not true. Like, you can be working 40 hours a week and maybe making $40,000 a year and still not have enough money for emergency resources in case of a storm. And we also know that climate is a threat multiplier. So for communities that face social ills, those things multiply in the face of a storm and after a storm. So the longer we don't have lights, the higher the crime gets, right? The longer we don't have electricity, we can't use the food stamps because it's electronic now. Yep. We don't have access to food. We already didn't have access because it was a food desert. Or even if you make the buses free, the buses barely run in my community on a regular day. So it was just those type of things. Or even landlords who take advantage of people who are on fixed income and evicting them right after storms. It was a lot of different layers of things that we were seeing, and those things were not inside of the disaster plans of our county or cities or any municipalities. And I'm just so happy that we were able to identify those gaps and bring that up.
And it sounds like, and Kate, that the institutions have welcomed this assistance that Valencia and others have brought into this, as opposed to opposed it and buried it under regulations and paperwork and triplicate forms and those types of things.
I think so. I think that part of that comes from the fact that Miami-Dade and Miami and Miami Beach are working on an overall community resilience strategy to deal with sea level rise and transportation and a lot of different basically quality of life issues in South Florida. And a big part of that is looking at some of the stresses that are already in our community. So, you know, if you're making $40,000 a week or a year and still having a hard time buying hurricane supplies, you know, poverty is a stress that just gets exacerbated when there's a hurricane, or if there's sea level rise. You know, we're seeing that with climate gentrification right now in Liberty City and Little Haiti, where the people who, you know, live there, you know, they tend to be lower income folks, and they are being bought out by developers, being asked to leave their communities, and they don't have necessarily a lot of recourse against that because of their financial situation.
Katie Swatowski, in Broward County, are you seeing any similar kind of grassroots efforts to fill in where it may be voids in the institutional preparation or response to storms?
I think we're seeing that when it comes to prepping shelters, and more people I've noticed are standing up and coming to county and city commission meetings and bringing up the issue of, hey, you need to do a better job at telling people how to prepare to come to a shelter, or how to, you know what to bring or know where to go in general. I think Broward has had a communication issue in terms of just getting people even to a shelter. Yeah. And when everyone says it's the area of last resort, that really doesn't help the people that cannot afford to leave. And so getting that contact to people who, you know, they can't evacuate, and letting them know how best they can prepare has been a big issue. So we've definitely seen more people standing up and saying, hey, you know, Broward County, especially during commission meetings, please, you know, work on this. And I think they have. There's been several campaigns by the county to come in and try to fill gaps where people have spoken out about them. But we're not, I haven't seen at least any similar grassroots efforts in terms of, you know, stockpiling a warehouse or community groups doing cookouts like this.
Valencia?
Yes, actually, Nancy and I are doing another grand opening in Broward for a warehouse. We having a CEOC Broward on September 22nd. Yes, because our operations was not just Dade County. We were in Dania, we were in Liberia, we were in South Broward, we were in Hollywood, certain parts of Fort Lauderdale last year also, because our operation actually went statewide, just people really focused in on Miami. But we actually are working on and building out the warehouse, just like we have the one here in Miami in Broward. And
that's going to open next week?
On the 22nd.
22nd of September, okay.
Yeah, we're really focusing in and building that one out now.
Great.
That's fantastic.
Yeah, also still talking about, what are the reminders for you 1 year after Hurricane Irma, talking about the response, lessons learned from the storm here on the Florida Roundup. Katie Swatowski covering Broward County, Kate Stein, our environmental transportation reporter, both with us here at WLRN. Valencia Gunder also back with us here on the Florida Roundup, Miami-Dade County community organizer. Your phone calls at 800-743-9576. And Shorecrest, Lisa has been very patient with us. Lisa, thank you for holding on. Tell us your story.
Thanks for having me, Tom. Well, the Shorecrest area is a very, very tight community. Everybody helps each other out, and it had been many years since that area was hit. And we're very vulnerable in a major flood zone. And there were some damages. I was kind of the new kid on the block. I had the house for 7 years. It was all paid off. Everybody else has been there 20, 30, 40 years. So a lot of us, I think all of us, don't have insurance. I had fire, theft, and liability because I'm an art collector. Mm-hmm. But some of the places and houses on our street, you know, all of us were flooded. I lost part of my roof. And I'm just very disappointed with FEMA. Being an honest person, they mm-hmm. asked if I had insurance, and I could only answer yes or no, so I said yes. And, you know, I have a file that's probably 6 inches thick, and I get a call 8.5 months later, mid-June, that an inspector wants to come by my house at 9 o'clock on a Sunday morning. Mm-hmm. I was forced to sell my house because I didn't have the $32,000 and change from two licensed general contractors who came in and gave me a quote. Mm-hmm. So at one point, FEMA gave me $499.50 to repair my house, and a little over $2,000 for because my house was inhabitable, for me to be able to go to a hotel.
So Lisa, did I hear you right that you have since sold your home?
Yeah, I had to take a great loss because I put $8,000 into it just to make it livable, inable, so to speak.
Right.
And then it just got to a point where I was getting nowhere with FEMA, and I was just... Not to be a whistleblower or anything, but there were people, you know, within my community that had a 3-minute conversation with FEMA.
Yeah.
And 2 days later, $20,000+ is deposited into their bank.
Did you stay in South Florida, Lisa?
Well, what I'm doing now after Irma and the scars, we are working on a shipping container project. And we're raising structures for low income and also luxury, where in my house as well. It's going to be raised way beyond the flood line, and we have other ones that are going to be raised 7 feet to completely mitigate any future risk of king tides, of hurricanes and windstorms.
Well, thanks for sharing your thoughts and your experiences with us here, Lisa. Certainly fully engaged there on the topic and obviously some emotional and scars otherwise still left for the community. Valencia Gunder, a Miami-Dade County community organizer who has been instrumental in getting communities to recognize the threat of hurricane and to prepare for some of the difficulties before and after the storm, for that matter. Valencia, always nice to have you on here at WLRN.
Thank you.
Thanks so much. Kate Stein covering the environment and transportation for us here at WLRN. Kate, thanks for your experiences as well.
Thanks, Tom.
And Katie Swatowski, she is going to stick with us. We've got lots more to come, but this final quick note on Hurricane Irma. Your reminder, Nina D. in Cutler Bay. This was my first hurricane. I was 7 months pregnant and not happy to be without power for 11 days. Nina writes, but what reminds me most, ironically, is the new growth on all the trees that lost limbs or more. There we go. 1 year after Hurricane Irma here on the Florida Roundup. Stick around. The State Commission investigating the Stoneman Douglas shooting sees the video of the school resource officer not entering the building as the shooting unfolds. Now they want to hear from him. That's next. Welcome back to the Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for listening.
We're having the presentation today on the exterior video and of what Peterson did. because we have subpoenaed Peterson to testify at our October meeting.
That was Pinellas County Sheriff Bob Gualtieri speaking at this week's meeting of the State Commission investigating the Stoneman Douglas School shooting. He's the chairman of that group. On Wednesday, the group watched surveillance video of Stoneman Douglas School Resource Officer Scott Peterson during the shooting as it unfolded on February 14th.
Peterson is sitting there at that door. He could have gone in and he could have just started shooting and putting rounds down range and potentially killed Cruz and taken him out on the first floor, which would have prevented all of the deaths and the people shot on the third floor.
Katie Swatowski, WLRN's Broward County reporter, sat in on much of the commission hearings this week. She's still with us via Skype. Describe that video the commission watched this week, Katie.
So it was pretty similar to the video that circulated right after the shooting happened, a few days after. And Scott Peterson was the school resource officer on duty. He was a Broward sheriff's officer stationed at Marjory Stoneman Douglas. Mm-hmm. And the video shows the shooting unfolding. And it's surveillance video from the outside. So you see Peterson take cover outside instead of going in. And I think the accusations here are that members of this commission really feel that he could have done something.
So they've seen how he responded. The video is there. The committee has subpoenaed him. He is due to testify in October. What's the committee after? They've already seen how he's reacted.
I think there's a few reasons for this. I think especially, you know, Sheriff Gualtieri is, you know, not happy about how Peterson went on the Today Show and spoke with the Wall Street Journal, Washington Post, right after the shooting. And he made himself available to media in June to talk about how he loves, you know, the students at Marjory Stoneman Douglas and how what he did was not an act of cowardice in any way and it shouldn't be seen that way. Mm. So in the commission's eyes, if he gets to tell his story one-sided, he should have to answer.
There was also a conversation with the commission this week about the student resource officers and their ability to essentially know what the disciplinary records are of the students that they are there to protect. Tell us a little about this.
Yes, this is really important because I think it can affect the future of the role of a school resource officer at schools across the whole state. And what that would mean is that a school resource officer could see disciplinary and educational records for each student. And, you know, certain students could be flagged for, you know, past behavioral issues. But they could also potentially be able to have access to these records for former students who could still pose threats, such as Nicholas Cruz.
Right.
And I think, you know, everyone in the commission loved this idea. I did not hear any talk otherwise. But it's interesting to see the reaction on Twitter. I've seen several people, you know, tweet in and comment, hey, wait, should parents have more, you know, access to records about the school resource officer? Shouldn't we flip this and be able to see who's really protecting our children?
Hmm. Well, to that point, in terms of sharing information, that's been long discussed with this commission about different agencies sharing different pieces of information, both in advance to try to stop any kind of threat like this, and that gets down to discipline records and others, and also sharing of information in real time when this kind of tragedy is unfolding. And this idea of a fusion center is something that's been talked about with this commission that's been borrowed from strategies that have been undertaken since September 11th, 2001.
Yes, fusion centers were created nationwide after 9/11, and they're all over Florida as well. There's seven main sections. And the idea is to, between law enforcement agencies, county and state agencies, all be able to talk to each other. And that's great in theory, but I think certain members of the commission, especially one of the fathers of the victims, Ryan Petty, looked at this in a way and argues it's reactive, not proactive. Mm. And that has been a major analysis goal of this commission.
Katie Swatowski has been covering the state commission investigating the Marjory Stoneman Douglas shooting. She's our Broward County reporter with us via Skype. Katie, thanks for sharing your reporting with us this week on the Florida Roundup.
Thanks, Tom.
That'll do it for our program this week. The Florida Roundup is produced by Alexandra Gonzalez. Richard Ives is our phone producer. Our engagement producer is Katie Lepre. Teresa Frontado is our digital director. WLRN's news director is Terrence Shepard. Alicia Zuckerman is our editorial director. Our technical supervisor and program director is Jason Zabka. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for calling. Thanks for tweeting. Thanks for listening. And most of all, thanks for supporting public radio in South Florida.